Hi, welcome to New Books in Politics. I'm your host, Jeff Bloodworth. Here's a fun historical fact for you. In 1932, the 1932 presidential election, Franklin Roosevelt won 98% of the vote in the state of South Carolina. The Republican Herbert Hoover won the remaining 2%. In the 2012 election, well, I don't think Mitt Romney will win 98% of the vote in South Carolina, but I think we all understand that things have definitely changed in how not just how South Carolina votes, but how the rest of the South also votes. In political history and political science, this is called realignment. And the big question is, why and how did the American South move from being the solidly Democratic South to what is now the solidly Republican South? For decades, historians and political scientists have essentially had a very simple narrative in how they explain this, and they say it's simply race. Well, Joseph Crespino, a professor of history at Emory University, has written what is really a fine and first-rate biography of Strom Thurmond. It's called Strom Thurmond's America, and in it, Crespino uses Thurmond to talk about how not only South Carolina, but how the rest of the South realigned. And what Crespino does is, of course, he talks about Thurmond's bigotry. But he also talks about, also makes a larger claim that realignment of the South was a lot more complicated than pure and simple race. I had a really nice conversation with Professor Crespino, and Strom Thurmond's America is a really fine and first-rate political biography. It's readable, it's accessible, and I think it makes some really important arguments, and I think it goes a long way in helping us have a more complicated understanding of modern American politics. I hope you enjoy our conversation. On today's show on New Books in History, we're going to have Joseph Crespino, and we're going to be talking about his fine new book, Strom Thurmond's America. Joe, we usually start by asking the author just to tell us a bit about yourself, biography, education background, educational background, that sort of thing.
Sure, sure. I got my PhD at Stanford in 2002, and before that, I was an undergrad at Northwestern University in Evanston, Illinois. In between undergrad and grad school, I was I taught for 2 years in the Mississippi Teacher Corps, which is a program where they put teachers with liberal arts degrees in under-resourced school districts in the Mississippi Delta. And so I taught in Indianola, Mississippi, at Gentry High School for 2 years.
That's B.B. King's hometown, isn't it?
That's right. And he would come back and do a homecoming concert every every spring, early summer. Yeah, he was really loyal to Indianola. And I did that for 2 years and then went out to grad school at Stanford and was on a postdoc for a year at George Mason University in Fairfax, Virginia, and then got a job here at Emory, and I've been here ever since. So this is my ninth year in the profession.
You and I, you know this, but the listeners don't. My family, we have a connection. My family is from Mississippi. I think we're essentially the same part of the state, Northwest Mississippi. Is that where your family's from?
Yeah, my family's from Macon, Mississippi, Knoxville County, so a little bit further south, kind of east central Mississippi.
Yeah.
Over in between Columbus and Meridian.
Oh, Columbus. Yeah, my grandmother went to Mississippi University for Women. I guess Columbus would be the – I think there's an Air Force base there, Naval base.
That's right.
Yeah,
that's right.
Yeah. We almost shared the same experience. I almost did the Mississippi Teacher Corps.
That's great.
Yeah. This does actually lead into one of my first question. I'm just curious. Maybe it has no connection whatsoever, but how does your Southernness shape your approach? I know you do the Southern history. So how do you think your Southernness shapes your approach to Southern history, and more specifically, your biography on Strom Thurmond?
I grew up in a small town, Macon, Mississippi, is about 2,500 people. My parents had lived in different places, where my mother's family is from, since before the Civil War. And my parents had lived in Cleveland, Ohio, and New York City, and they moved back to Mississippi, and my father started a business there. My father had been a professional football player, so he needed to find something to do after his playing days were over. And so he moved back to this small town where my mother's family had been from, and he started the cable television business in the local area. And this was in 1969, 1970. It was a time when public schools in small towns across the South were going through great tumult over desegregation, and there was a private academy that was founded in my hometown, like many private, like small southern towns were, where all the white kids went and all the black kids went to the public school once they were allowed to go to the traditionally white public school. And so I grew up in a town in the 1970s and early 80s in which the legacies of racial segregation were still very real, where there was a lot of kind of racial tension in the air. And you kind of could feel it even as a young kid, you know, like when you'd have, when black friends of mine would come over and play pickup basketball in my driveway, the neighbors would complain to my mother and things like that. And so, you know, I always felt like, you know, you would kind of learn different things as you come of age about the history of the civil rights movement and the history of segregation. And they were all things that I could relate to, or I could see, still see evidence of. I went to a doctor's, you know, office. The general practitioner, you know, his office was still segregated racially into the 80s, you know, things like this. And so I was always fascinated by that and wanted to learn more about it. And eventually I went to, I left Mississippi when I was 14. I went to a boarding school in Chattanooga, Tennessee, and then went on to undergraduate in Chicago. And I got involved in a community organizing project on the near west side of Chicago as an undergraduate. And there, it was in the Henry Horner homes. They don't exist anymore, but they tore them down. But at the time, I would meet residents there. And so many of the residents were, they would find out I'm from Mississippi, and they'd say, oh, I've got, you know, people in Winona, or my folks are from Greenwood. And they were all part of that historic migration of African Americans from Mississippi in the South to the North. And that's what, you know, that was a revelation to me as well, you know, because I've always felt growing up that I was from this very peculiar, unique place. And then you go to a city like Chicago, which is the biggest, you know, one of the most segregated big cities in all the country, in all the United States. And so, you know, should have been obvious to me, but it wasn't. But it became obvious how all of these things were of a piece. And I wanted to, so I ended up going back to Mississippi working in the Delta, but I wanted to write and research more about Southern history and racial politics and civil rights history in modern America. And so that's what I did in my first book, which is a book about Mississippi, a book about white resistance to civil rights in Mississippi, and trying to tell that story not as a kind of just, or not simply as a story about rabid white resistance in Mississippi that was part of a closed society set apart from a broader liberal America, but rather as to try to understand white Mississippians as they understood themselves, which was that they were part of this, they were at the forefront of this reaction of conservative Americans against these liberal social changes of the 1960s, and how they tried to make common cause with other conservative groups and conservative issues to kind of forge a this conservative counter movement from the in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. And that, so trying to take the story of resistance in Mississippi and put it in a broader national history of conservative politics since the 1960s. And so what I did in that book was to take something, take a state that we always think of as being outside the normal experience on the edge. Mississippi was the most, was widely considered, and it was the most reactionary southern state and resistant southern state. And I tried to take what was on the edges and move it to the center and see how the South and the nation look differently. In some ways, it's the same thing I'm doing in the Strom Thurmond book.
Yeah.
Is I'm taking a figure who's always thought of as quintessentially Southern, mm-hmm. right? One of the last of the Jim Crow demagogues, Strom Thurmond was, and then try to fit him into a national context and understand how he figures into conservative politics in the second half of the 20th century. And I think he's oftentimes, by the people who write that, oftentimes left out for a variety of reasons. For conservatives themselves who tell their own histories, Thurmond is kind of the crazy uncle you want to kind of keep in the attic of mm-hmm. the modern conservative revolution.
Yeah.
And for scholars who have been writing about conservatism over the last decade and a half or more, I think we tend to make kind of facile distinctions between kind of principled conservatives, intellectuals, Sunbelt conservatives, and those crazy racist Southerners.
Hmm.
And I'm trying in this book to complicate both notions, you know, to say that Thurmond wasn't, you can't just dismiss him as a crazy uncle, that he was there all along, and he was working in important ways on important issues that would become vital to the politics of the right in the 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s. And that we can't just dismiss him as merely as one of the last of the Jim Crow demagogues, that we need to properly understand him as also, at the same time, one of the first of the Sunbelt conservatives. And he didn't start off as one and gradually morph into the other as he mm-hmm. shed his racist regional heritage. From roughly 1948 to sometime in the 1970s, he was both at the same time one of the last of the Jim Crow demagogues and one of the first of the Sunbelt conservatives. And historians don't have a good way of thinking about that, how that could be. It's a paradox that we need to understand, and it forces us to think more about both groups and about how white Southern conservatives fit into national conservative politics.
Yeah, I think you did a really, really fine job with that. That's something I didn't know about Strom Thurmond, about how – and I have that dichotomy in my class when I teach. And I'm like,
right.
Okay, here's Barry Goldwater. You know, this is, you know, somehow the Sunbelt conservative who's the good guy, though he opposed
right.
the civil rights legislation. And then on the other hand, we have someone like a Strom Thurmond. And I this is my area of expertise is 20th century U.S. political history. I thought I knew something about this. And so it was great yeah. to read something and learn something entirely new. I mean, could you just tell us what is the difference? I mean, what do we think of it as the difference between a Southern conservative and a Sunbelt conservative? Could you just talk about that? Because I think it's an important
yeah.
distinction.
Well, let's take those two figures you were just talking about, Goldwater. And it's I think what I try to do is just complicate that story and who are these men and what's their relationship like? Well, Goldwater, we know, had been a member of the NAACP mm-hmm. in Phoenix when they were desegregating their schools. And when he ran in the South, the segregationist Democrats used to use that against him,
yeah.
right? But I found a number of really interesting things too about Goldwater. Well, you know, in his papers there in Arizona, you know, when he was, for example, when he was leading the Senate Reelection Campaign Committee in 1962, you know, that was a big year to try to push Southern Republicans and try to get some Southern Republicans elected in the Southern states. And Goldwater, as he emerges, you know, he's reelected in 58, right?
Mm-hmm.
And he emerges there as kind of the darling of kind of business interests and who are fighting labor unions. And he's part of this, you know, hard anti-union right that's trying to assert itself in the Republican Party. And Thurmond's working, you know, in lockstep with him on those efforts. I mean, he's not in the Republican Party at that point, but he's on the Labor and Public Welfare Committee with Goldwater in 1957 and 58 when they're trying to fight unions and that kind of thing. And, you know, the labor reform bill, trying to fight that in the late 50s.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where it's in those efforts that Thurmond and Goldwater developed their close friendship. In fact, in 1957, when Strom Thurmond led his record filibuster, 24 hours and 18 minutes, the only person who gave him any break at all in the middle of the night when he was like deep in the nighttime hours, 2 or 3 in the morning. Barry Goldwater came and introduced some measures on the floor for about 40 minutes so that Thurman could steal away for his only bathroom break. None of the other Southerners would have helped Thurman at that point because Thurman's filibuster was to them a great insult. It made them look like they were abandoning the cause and giving up the fight against the 57 Civil Rights Bill. But Goldwater and Thurman developed a relationship around kind of anti-union politics and also hardline anti-communist politics. They're two of the biggest hawks in the Senate in the late 50s and early 60s. They get together, work closely on allegations about muzzling in the military by the Kennedy Department, the Kennedy State and Defense Department in the early 60s. And then you look at the issue of civil rights. And we remember that Goldwater had formerly been a member of the NAACP. And there are people like in South Carolina, a guy like Bill Workman, who was running for the Senate as a Republican, first serious candidate on the Republican ticket since Reconstruction. He wins 40% of the vote against the Democrat, Olin Johnson, in the 1962 Senate race in South Carolina. And Goldwater comes into the South Carolina and stumps for Workman. Workman positively reviews conscience of a conservative, and he emphasizes the chapters there on states' rights and on civil rights. And he says, this is a guy who really understands us and knows what we're doing.
Mm-hmm.
And Goldwater is very cagey on civil rights and states' rights throughout the early 60s when he's trying to build a national constituency that's going to give him a path to winning the nomination and to running for president. And their letters with Bill Workman and Barry Goldwater, Workman asks him, says, what do I tell people? And they tell me he used to be a member of the NAACP. And Goldwater says, it's true. I did join it for a while. But now the NAACP are all my greatest enemies. They're all in cahoots with the socialists and the labor unions and the people who are leading us down a slippery slope to socialism in this country. And then you look at the correspondence between Goldwater and Strom Thurmond. There's a great exchange of letters I found in 1962 where Goldwater sends Thurmond a copy of civil rights legislation that had been passed by the Virgin Islands.
Mm-hmm.
And you look at the measures, and it's basically all of it is like a blueprint for what would eventually become the law in the 1964 Civil Rights Act. I mean, it was about regulating private business, desegregating public accommodations, racial equality in the workplace, that kind of thing. And Goldwater sends Thurmond a copy of this legislation that had been passed and highlights different parts and like put exclamation points in the margins. It's like, can you believe this stuff? Can you believe the way they're using government to enforce these things, to invade the rights of private businesses? I mean, it's just, it's crazy. This is, if we're not careful, this is what's going to be, they're going to try here. And Thurmond writes to Doug and says, you're absolutely right. It's just madness. I can't believe it either. And this is what I want people to understand. It's not that we just have very pat images, right? That mm-hmm. Thurmond was a foam at the mouth segregationist who woke up every morning thinking, what am I going to do today to keep black people down?
Yeah.
And that Barry Goldwater is a principled conservative who voted against the 64 Civil Rights Act because it violated the rights of private business. It's almost a parody of mm-hmm. It doesn't get at all at the complicated intersections on race and conservative ideology that existed for both men, right?
Yeah.
I mean, and they did see eye to eye. And for conservatives like Barry Goldwater, who are not from the South, people like Raymond Moley, who had been a New Deal Democrat and had left the Democratic Party and now is a spokesman for issues on the right and conservatism throughout the 40s and 50s. Raymond Moley's book published in the early 60s says, all of this generation of conservatives, they just feel like these issues about whether black school children and white school children in the South go to school together, like that's just not that big a deal to them compared to the serious issues about communism internationally and getting government out of the way of business and freeing up the economy. One of the things I want to say in the book is that for a person like Goldwater or Reagan later on, there's a kind of, they were just kind of tone deaf to the to what in the South was the fact that you had a really, you had a political system that was broken. You did not fundamentally have democratic governance in the Southern states until you had the civil rights movement.
Yeah.
And they just were completely tone deaf to that and didn't understand that at all. And, you know, for a guy like Barry Goldwater was perfectly happy, I mean, eager to work with a guy like Strom Thurmond to build a Republican Party in the South and to build it in a way that could blend their conservative ideology and use that to win over these white Southern Democrats who were in flight from the Democratic Party because of the issue of civil rights.
Yeah, I thought you did especially the stuff on Goldwater and his, you know, trying to explain away his membership in the NAACP. And I thought that was like, well, of course he would. You know, I'd always thought of my, you know, one-dimensional caricature of Goldwater as a principled conservative who, you know, and of course he's a practicing politician. And
he is. That's right.
And he needs to sell out the NAACP.
Right, and I think oftentimes, and when we write the histories of conservatism, and we forget about, you know, this distinction between the intellectuals and the activists and the people who are in the arena, and we think about Goldwater and Reagan as being principled conservatives, but you know, they are so pragmatic. They are they're enormously pragmatic minded politicians who oftentimes, if you look through Goldwater's papers, I mean, he is throwing up his hands at the ideologues and intellectuals who he, in his mind, he's contemptuous of because they've never had to even run for dog catcher before, you know. And yet they're talking about, you know, issues of principle. I mean, that was the basis of of Goldwater's speech, right, at the 1960 Republican National Convention. He's like, grow up, conservatives, right? You tried to nominate me, and I didn't get it, but grow up and support Richard Nixon and let's get with it. And Goldwater was totally that way. But what's fascinating, too, about Goldwater is, you know, he was doing what he needed to do in the early 60s to get Southerners, to get the support of Southerners, and to try to win that nomination because he wanted he had national aspirations. But after he loses, in 64, you know, he's out of the Senate. He runs again, and he has to be reelected in 68 for a new seat. And it's fascinating, too, to see the exchanges between Goldwater and Thurmond at that point. When Goldwater's running for the Senate and Strom Thurmond is coming out in 1968 with a book, his only book. It's a book kind of, you know, talking about his conservative ideology. And Lee Edwards edited it. He says that he didn't ghostwrite it, although all the Thurmond's staffers told me that Lee Edwards, that was the word they used, that he ghostwrote it. But Lee Edwards wouldn't be interviewed about it. He didn't want to talk to me to be interviewed about the project, though he did want to review the book in the Wall Street Journal and correct me when I used the term that he ghostwrote it. But anyway, so Lee Edwards edited this book for Thurmond, and Thurmond was trying to get Goldwater to write the foreword, and he wrote and sent him a copy of the book and said, would you write a foreword for the book? And Goldwater begged off, and he said, you know, there's a couple of things in there that I don't quite, you know, I agree with, so I would prefer not to, you know. And Thurmond wrote him back and said, look, Barry, if there are things that you don't agree with, let me know and I can change them. Because, you know, we've been together on this stuff for a long time. And if there are things you think are wrong, let me know. And Goldwater wrote him back and said, no, there's nothing that's wrong. It's just, and then he said, he kind of hemmed and hawed and got around finally to saying it was about the Brown decision. He said, I understand that you disagreed with the Brown decision, he tried to carve out this different position on Brown. But if you read what Thurmond's book says about the Brown decision and what Goldwater says about the Brown decision in Conscience of Conservatism, I mean, it's indistinguishable.
Yeah.
You know, it's the classic conservative thing that the court doesn't have jurisdiction over education. Education is a local issue. And that it's assumed too much authority and all the rest. And that's exactly what Thurmond says. It's not like in his book in 68, Thurmond's saying, you know, we got to keep black and white school children apart because black children aren't equal to white children. I mean, you know, Thurmond never says that, you know. And so it's a great little example of how, you know, Goldwater needs Thurman in 1960 and 1962. South Carolina Republicans need him. Southern Republicans need him because Thurman is the white whale. Thurman is that dissident white Southern Democrat who's going to who represents those voters that that Republicans need if they're going to conservative Republicans need if they're going to take over their national party and they're going to run a national candidate. But in 1968, very different scene. Goldwater is running for re-election in Arizona. He'd been out of office for 4 years. He has always, throughout his career, had to battle accusations that he's an extremist and that he's in cahoots with the extremists. And it would do him no favors in 1968, when he's running against a Democratic candidate, to endorse and write a foreword for a book for Strom Thurmond, the South's biggest segregationist, right? And that old racist right wing wacko. So, you know, it's interesting how you know Goldwater needs him in the early 60s. He doesn't need him. He needs to distance himself by the late 60s. It's just that's the story. This kind of uneasy place that. The major theme of the book is this kind of uneasy place that Thurman has. They both need him, and yet they're always trying to distance themselves from him too at different times.
Yeah, I thought that was really interesting because I'd always, you know, I guess I never realized that how the rest, like Dick Russell and the rest of the Southern, you know, Democratic senators, how little regard they held for Thurman and, you know, that he was always on the outside sort of looking in. I mean, that was – is that right?
Well, I think I would say it a little bit differently in that he had – Thurman's decision, it was a rash decision, but in 48, his decision to leave the Dixiecrat cause really burned bridges for him that in a way that would shape the rest of his career and the kinds of options that were open to him. It burned the bridge with the establishment Democratic Party in South Carolina. And that then kind of alienated him from other kind of establishment Southern Democrats who ran the Senate, who were the power brokers, right, in the Southern caucus that had so much power through the 1950s, really until it was finally broken in 1964 when they broke the filibuster that passed the 64 Civil Rights Act. But, you know, Richard Russell was the quintessential establishment Southern Democratic official. I mean, he was the head of the Southern Caucus, this very well-respected person. But Russell was skeptical of Thurman. And Russell just – he was – he knew that Thurman was – had a huge ambitious streak and that he was going to out to make a name for himself. And he was. When Thurman got into the Senate, he came in 1955, late 1954. They appointed him early. But when he came in, Thurman had made this – he had won on this right-end candidacy, unprecedented, right? He was a right-end candidate. And that's a whole other story that made him an enemy to the establishment Democratic Party in South Carolina. But he comes into the Senate, and he has to run again in 1956. He's pledged to the South Carolina voters that he's going to put the race back into the Democratic Party Democratic Party primary in South Carolina in 56. So he's going to have to run 56, and then he has to run again in 60 because by that time the seat would be up again. Mm-hmm. So Strom Thurmond actually had to run three times for the U.S. Senate in the first 6 years.
Yeah.
And so, as I say in the book, it makes a man who's normally obsessed with his political, you know, fortunes even more so. You know? I mean, this kind of unprecedented series of events in which he has to run. And he's convinced at every one that the establishment Democrats back in South Carolina are going to put somebody up against him and try to defeat him. And so he's running hard. So he doesn't go through this period where a lot of senators do, where you kind of lay low for a while and learn the ropes and, you know, ease your way into things. And that's certainly the way it would have been in the Southern Caucus, you know, where all those guys had been there for years and years, and you got to be deferential and respectful and know where you are and who to kowtow to and who not to. Well, that wasn't in Thurman's makeup anyway. I mean, he wasn't going to be doing that kind of thing. It's just wasn't in his personality. But he really wasn't going to be doing it, given the circumstances in which he was going to have to be running again and again. And so he goes, what does he do? He goes in and leads the effort for the Southern Manifesto, which the other Southerners are kind of uneasy about. Basically, Thurman's trying to take this kind of grassroots movement out there across the South that's interested in these old antiquated, musty notions of interposition and nullification. And he wants to, and all these state legislatures have been passing these nullification, interposition resolutions. And Thurman says, hey, we should do this in the Senate too. And this is no, and you know, Richard Russell would just have no interest in this at all. But he waters that down.
I found that particularly fascinating, how the Southern Democratic establishment wanted nothing to do with the Southern Manifesto. Sorry to interrupt you, but that I found that really interesting.
Well, Richard Russell just thought it would have done nothing for them. It just would have stirred up the liberals. It was just totally a kind of a symbolic thing that Russell was really worried about, federal civil rights legislation being passed and and losing the filibuster, because throughout this period, from the 40s and 50s, the Senate, it was a constant threat for the Southerners that the Senate was going to revise the filibuster rules to make it easier to break a filibuster. And Richard Russell, who knew the score, knew that once that happened, the game was up. And in fact, it had become so precarious for them that they couldn't even really filibuster. You know, by 1957, that's the great compromise that Russell makes, is that he avoids the filibuster, because to use the filibuster to resist it was simply going to invite a larger onslaught in which liberals would be able to probably to amass the votes to revise the filibuster rule, and then the game would be up. So that's what LBJ helps him do in 57, helps Russell do, is as majority leader, LBJ helps Russell dilute the 57 legislation, reduce it just to a voting rights measure, and then a really weak voting rights measure at that, and they pass that. And symbolically, it's important, right? It's the first civil rights legislation passed since Reconstruction, but immediately civil rights forced. And they knew it beforehand. It wouldn't give any real protections for the vote in the South. And that's why you had the 60 legislation, and ultimately why you had the legislation in 64. And you needed this legislation in 64 and 65. But yeah, I think the Southern power brokers, they were leery of Thurman, because they thought that he was a grandstander, that he was only interested in himself, and that he would do, and that he was unreliable, erratic, that he was going to do whatever he needed to advance his own interests, and that he wasn't going to be a team player. And of course, they were exactly right in the 57, on a one-man filibuster, where he basically went behind their backs. I mean, he says he didn't, but he did.
Yeah. I mean, this is, I'm working on a biography of someone that I admire. This is a difficult biography, because I was reading it and getting a sense of Thurman as this obsessed politician. I kind of thought of him as LBJ without the charm. I'm not sure. Can you tell us a little bit about writing a biography about somebody who, it's difficult to like?
Yeah, well, he was charmless and humorless in that period, in his early years in the Senate, certainly from 55 through really through the early 70s or so, where he's really – that's the most fascinating part of his career too, because it's when he's most alienated from both parties. And he's this independent operator trying to carve out this space in national politics. And that's when he's so he's really kind of out there on his own in many ways. And but he is, there are different moments. I mean, the Youngstrop Thurman has his charms. He starts moonlight literacy classes for African Americans in Edgefield County. Mm-hmm. A young kind of progress minded, very ambitious young man. Ardent New Dealer in the 1930s. In the one term he serves in the legislature, World War II hero. I mean, absolutely undisputed. Chest full of decorations that he had when he ended World War II. Volunteered as a 40-year-old to crash land a glider behind German lines on D-Day.
Mm-hmm.
And then they fought their way out. Just a remarkable, remarkable military record. And then this very complicated figure by the end of his life, you know, someone who did, I mean, he did charm people by the end of his life, by the 80s and 90s, when he became this kind of, you know, odd ball kind of senator in jogging shorts. And then later, you know, this kind of lecherous, liver spotted old man in the 90s, you know, there's so many different iterations. There's not like there's a thin Elvis and a fat Elvis with Strom Thurmond. You know, there are just about 10 or 12 different Strom Thurmonds over the course of his 100-year life. But I was just always, I mean, he's just fascinating as a figure for all of his chameleon-like qualities, his ability to reinvent himself at different moments, and his just unending, his just tireless dedication to his own political interests. You know?
Yeah.
It's just fascinating. Yeah.
So, I mean, one thing I really liked about your book, I mean, and I think I've mentioned this before, but I think it bears repeating and maybe just talk a little bit about it, is, look, Strom Thurmond didn't come to conservatism by way of bigotry. Right? He's a bigot. Okay. But he was always a conservative. Okay. And so what does that tell us about the larger story of realignment? And, you know, the typical narrative is, okay, yes, voting rights revolution, civil rights revolution, South becomes conservative. But it seems mm-hmm. that through Thurmond, you know, is there something more there as the South is becoming less some sort of economic colony of the North that conservatives are able to compete on a more equal footing? I mean, could you just talk about that?
Yeah, I was trying to understand Thurmond's bigotry alongside and how it intersects with these other issues that are important, as I say in the book, in kind of Sunbelt conservatism.
Mm-hmm.
And I do think I think I would agree with what you say there, that Thurmond comes to conservatism from, you know, I mean, he's talking about states' rights. He's talking about the rights of states relative to the federal government in 1948. Now, he's doing that in the context where he's leading this completely racist third party movement. But that's his struggle, right, is to make it about political ideology and not about racism. And he mm-hmm. failed miserably. That race was always about the vehement opposition that had been provoked in the South by Truman's civil rights policy. So he tries and fails in 1948. But over the course of the 1950s, this really interesting shift happens in his labor and business politics. He had been this labor advocate in the 1930s when he was a New Deal Democrat. And then he starts to see, when he's governor, how there's this important new entity in Southern politics, right? That the people that used to be just be kind of easily dismissed as the mill owners, you know, mm-hmm. those kind of rich Republicans who were on the margins of politics in the South, there's a whole new emphasis now coming from all the governor's offices across the South on economic development. It's the catchword, right?
Yeah.
Of the post-World War II South. Every governor is racing now to be the best salesman for their state and bring in and pass right to work laws and bring in outside industry. And in the doing that, they're going to corporate boardrooms up in the North. Mm. So Thurmond goes up to DuPont in 1950. And those folks in DuPont, they don't think of Strom Thurmond as just this crazy old Southern segregationist. He comes into the corporate boardroom at DuPont and is there with a guy like Charles Daniel. Charles Daniel was the head of Daniel Construction, which by the early 1960s would be one of the biggest construction corporations in the country, one ahead of Bechtel. Hmm. I mean, the top 10, it was right there alongside Bechtel and Brown and Root in terms of its size and the amount of money it was making. Charles Daniel was building industrial plants all across the Southeast for people like Roger Milliken, mm-hmm. the textile magnate the textile family, who was a huge figure in Republican and right-wing funding Republican and right-wing causes. He was a big money man behind Goldwater's campaign in 1964. And Thurman goes up there as governor, and they don't see him as a crazy Southern segregationist. They see him as a former presidential candidate who ran against Harry Truman and had all these criticisms against Harry Truman. Thurman would start those meetings. Charles Daniel tells in his memoir about how Thurman would start that meeting, you know, pitching relocation sites in South Carolina by looking around the room. And he says, "I think there's more brains around this table than there is in all of Harry Truman's cabinet," you know, and that kind of thing. You know, the idea that, you know, they understood, they were simpatico in their rejection of Harry Truman and the liberals who were running the Democratic Party. So Thurman, you know, that issue of anti-union politics and pro-business politics that Thurman embraces over the course of the 1950s, so that by the 1960s he's as big a foe of labor unions as he is of civil rights organizations. The embrace of a hard right, what we would call today a belief in American exceptionalism abroad, but yeah, a hard right anti-communist position, which Thurman embraced. It comes directly out of his military experience. He had been trained in the military as a cadet at Clemson University in the 20s, and he had been involved in the reserves always. And he was a hero of World War II, and he would become the Reserve Officers Association national president when he left the governorship in the early 1950s before he became a senator. So he was very frustrated by the late 50s with what he felt like was the internationalist kind of presence, liberal international presence in the National Democratic Party that was going to give away the game internationally to the communists. And he was, you know, a big fan of Douglas MacArthur and thought that they'd given away the game in Korea and didn't want it to happen in Vietnam. So, all, you know, it's not like Thurman, you know, issues of anti-union politics, issues of anti-communism. He's also, you know, putting together, working with religious conservatives in the South in a way. Decades, we wouldn't call them the religious right in the 1950s and 60s. That term wasn't coined until the 70s, but that's what it was when Strom Thurmond was working with those religious conservatives who would eventually come to play such an important role in conservative politics. So all of that, Thurman is involved in all of those issues, and we have no sense of that in our previous histories of Thurman, how deeply involved he was in all of these kinds of issues, and how Thurman saw himself as these were the issues that, you know, that he was a conservative, that he, yeah, although he wouldn't use that term, he certainly wouldn't use that term in 1948. That term was death in Southern politics in 1948. Nobody would have used that term. You would have called yourself a states' rights Democrat, a Jacksonian Democrat, you know. In fact, you know, there's early in Barry Goldwater's career, he didn't even use the term, or he was careful about using it. He'd call himself a Jacksonian Democrat. Ellie Shermer's book on Goldwater, she talks about that language and the difficulty of that term, conservative, even as late as the 1950s. You know, for politicians who are in the realm, you know, maybe people, you know, sure, William F. Buckley would have been calling himself a conservative. William F. ran for political office. Well, he did. He ran for mayor. I take that back. He didn't win it, though.
Sure.
But you know, I mean, conservatives and intellectuals can call themselves conservatives, but politicians, you got to be careful about that thing.
Yeah.
You know. So that's Thurman. I think that's right. Thurman was involved in all of those issues in important ways that we have just forgotten all about.
Yeah, I mean, this is what I really – reading your book, and again, I know historians aren't – we're not supposed to think anecdotally, but we still do, or at least I do.
Yeah.
And I read this and I you know, I remember my grandfather talking about voting for – what he would always use Fielding Wright first because he was the Mississippian, but voting for Thurman and Fielding Wright. But I always got a sense of my family, you know, that grew up voting Republican, that – there was more to their conservatism than just bigotry, right? I mean, the bigotry was absolutely there. I mean, they're very much people of their time. But I really think you did a nice, you know, sort of Strom Thurmond being kind of a stand-in for conservative white Southerners of the mid-century and, you know, a more complicated picture. And you know, I really – this is – and it's a fun read too. I mean, you kind of
– you know,
it's really something. And urge all our listeners to go out and buy this.
Thank you. Yeah.
I have one last question, and I know you just finished this book, but what is your next project?
Yeah, I know. I did just finish it. It was hard to kind of get my head around doing something different. But I do. I have been thinking about some other things. I've got two ideas that are really interesting to me. I probably will move forward with both of them until I figure out which one I want to focus my attention on. But one is I have a longstanding interest in Atticus Finch, the hero of To Kill a Mockingbird.
Yeah, huh.
And I've just long been fascinated by him. And fascinated by the fascination with Atticus Finch, and I'd like to write a book about Atticus in that novel and its enduring kind of influence as a way for understanding kind of American morality on racial issues. You know,
yeah.
Atticus is just this unimpeachable hero. You know,
yeah.
He's voted the great Hollywood movie hero of the 20th century, the number one greatest hero in the movies, and that novel is read and taught so often to school children. You know, it becomes like the morality tale that we tell about race relations in this country. And so I'd like to think about Atticus Finch. What is it that we love so much about Atticus Finch? What are the qualities that and then try to relate that to kind of, well, he's a Southern liberal, he's a stoic, he's a father. It's just an interest, just a fascinating figure. So I don't know exactly what shape that would take, but something I'm turning around in my mind. And then the other thing is I want to write a book about the civil rights era and the civil rights struggle that can really bring home to readers the degree to which, for white and black Southerners both, the civil rights movement represented both the civil rights struggle represented both a political crisis, but it was also a kind of spiritual crisis for so many people, and it was a time really when their belief in their world, the way they understood the world, just really there's this feeling that so much was at stake.
Yeah,
and the way they saw the world, and the way they understood themselves, and the way they understood everything. I don't know exactly how to do that. Although I think, I'm toying around with some ideas about how to do that in a way that you could do it in a narrative history, that you could tell a story, a history that would capture those themes. And one of the things that interests to me. That may be a way to do that is to look at those, when they were debating the civil rights movement, civil rights bill in 1964, there were these seminarians, Jewish seminarians, Protestants, Catholics, who got together on the mall in Washington and held prayer vigil, 24-hour prayer vigils continuously on this, there by the Lincoln Memorial until the bill was passed. And partly this interest comes out of when I was researching my first book, I was going through the papers of John Stennis, the senator from Mississippi.
Yeah.
And he wrote a memo to file. He was great about doing this, where he just reflect on things. And his memo to files was going to basically, it was all kind of like, why did we lose the fight? Why did were they able to get cloture, vote for cloture on the 64 legislation? And he goes through the list of things, and he said, and really one of the most profound things were those prayer vigils. They just really had a huge impact in swaying public opinion. And I always thought, wow, that's really something for him to say.
Yeah.
And I wanted to find out more about them. And I think I think there's an interesting just story to be told about those vigils, and that could be a frame for doing a larger history about the passage of that bill and the religious and the racial arguments, divisions, debates that were roiling the country at that moment and that had been roiling the country for decades before and that we continue to live with today.
Wow, that sounds like a great book. It seems like that there, the veritable hole in the literature really is there, and that, a region that is as religious as the South really deserves that sort of treatment. That sounds like a really interesting book. I vote for the second, but
okay.
This is not a democracy.
Well, that's how we decide these things, right? you tell your ideas to people, you know, over beers at a bar, and the one that people kind of light up around, you end up writing that one.
Well,
at least that's it's your sounding board.
Yeah, I got to tell you, I've been, you know, reading your work for a few years now, and you know, and I was so delighted to find out that you're a Mississippian. Because I know Northerners can do our history quite well. But it's always good, I think, at least when, somebody from the region, I just think there is something about the South, you know, that it does take sometimes an insider I don't know, maybe a Northerner could have done the Strom Thurmond biography in the same way, but it's a really fine book. It really
is. Well, I appreciate that, Jeff. Yeah, there are advantages and disadvantages to be an insider or an outsider, but there are relative merits to both. And there have been great Northerners who have written wonderfully about the South, and people from all over the world, obviously. But,
Well, thank you for your time, I appreciate it.
Okay. Yeah, thank you. It's been a pleasure talking with you.
Okay, have a good day.
You too. Bye-bye.
Well, I hope you've enjoyed my interview and conversation with Joe Crispina. Hope it makes you want to go out and buy what really is a fine book, Strom Thurmond's America. And I hope you subscribe to this podcast and talk about it on Facebook and spread the word. I will see you next week.